In our study of Bible symbols, we have examined an object, that is the Bible. We've also studied a creature. Last week, that was the devil. Tonight, as we think about Bible symbols, we want to make things a little more personal. How does the Bible symbolize God's people? The folks that want to go to heaven, the people who are seeking to put God first in their lives, how does God symbolize them in the Scriptures? If this is something that we've never thought about, something that we've never studied about tonight, I think we might be a little surprised at some of the symbols. The Bible uses many symbols to describe God's people. In fact, there are really too many to divide up into one lesson, let alone maybe two, but I want to split this information into two segments, one tonight and then the other next Sunday evening. I'm going to draw initially from three passages, 1 Corinthians 9, and I'll be reading 1 Corinthians 9:24 to 27 in just a moment. After we get that information before us, then I'm going to slip over to the book of 2 Timothy and pull from 2 Timothy chapter 2. And then our third passage will be Hebrews chapter 12. As you turn to 1 Corinthians 9, you'll see as we start with the reading in verse 24 that Paul tells Christians, run. He compares the Christian life, he symbolizes the Christian life to a race. Now we know, I think, or we should know, based on the word run, that he's not using this word literally. Not everybody is able to literally run. Or if they're able to run well in the early years, as the later years come, and sometimes there are problems with legs and whatnot, people lose that ability or it's restricted. But we can run in the spiritual sense. And this is what Paul had in mind as he symbolizes the Christian race with athletics. 1 Corinthians 9:24, he says, know ye not that they that run in a race run all, but one receiveth a prize. Even so run that ye may obtain. Verse 25. And every man that striveth in the games exercises self-control in all things. Now they do it to receive a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. Therefore, so run as not uncertainly, or as uncertainty, so fight I, as not beating the air, but I buffet my body and bring it into bondage, lest by any means, after that I have preached to others, I myself should be rejected. Paul makes it clear that the Christian life is symbolized by race. He also, in these verses, speaks of self-discipline. He talks about in verse 26, having a sense of direction or goal, a purpose. And that's what athletes do. The end of verse 26 brings to mind the image of a boxer. And Paul says, as I'm thinking about the Christian life, as I'm living my life, that boxer, when he is trying to deal with an opponent, he doesn't just mindlessly punch in the air, but he's going for some part in the body. He tries to time his blows. He tries to position his blows so that they are effective, that they land somewhere in a spot which is really going to matter. So Paul said, I don't want to beat the air. Then in verse 27, that final passage that was read, Paul, as he thinks about athletics, says self-restraint. Self-discipline is involved in the process. This is also true for Christianity. Now these verses are pretty specific, but they're supplemented by some other passages, the next being 2 Timothy chapter 2, which I'm going to read from, that also amplify or add to the athletic imagery in 1 Corinthians 9. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, as Paul writes to this young preacher a second letter, he says this, and if also a man contend in the games, he is not crowned, except he have contended lawfully. Here's Paul once again brings to mind athletic games. These were very common in the first century. And Paul said, if people are going to contend, if they're going to contend successfully, he said they have to abide by the rules. There are certain laws that they must abide by if they want to go ahead and participate. Well, once again, as we'll see in a moment, this is also true for the Christian. I'm going to come back to, at least in principle, 2 Timothy 2 and 1 Corinthians 9. But let's get that next passage before us, which I mentioned. This comes from Hebrews chapter 12, looking at the first verse. Therefore, the writer is drawing a conclusion. Let us also, seeing that we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run the race. Let us run that race, he says, patiently. Well, just like 1 Corinthians 9, Paul's there, and the Hebrew writer in Hebrews 12 says we're a race. The Hebrew writer tells us, as he talks about this particular symbol, run the race with patience. When we think about the Christian life, God compares it to an athletic contest. Now, this information or this symbol is instructive because it provides us with several key pieces of information. When we think about athletes, we typically find people who are not alone. Athletes are people who have others with them. We think, for example, about the trainers that athletes have. It might just be a high school coach, but there is someone who is out there that's generally giving some kind of guidance, some kind of encouragement or instruction to the athlete. In addition to the coaching that's done or the training that's being done, athletes have competitors. Generally, if it's a boxer, there's someone in the ring with him. If it's an athlete out on the track, there's probably going to be another competitor with him to go ahead and run that race. Well, the Christian life, we have a competitor. We have someone that's running against us. And the Bible, as we learned last week, identifies this competitor as Satan. Athletes need to train for what they do. They just don't go out one day and say, well, I'm going to run 5 miles and I'm going to do well. That'll kill some people. But they need to go ahead and build up. They need to strengthen the body. And that's also true for the Christian. That's why Peter said, grow. You desire that spiritual milk so you can grow, so you can increase, so you can become a stronger Christian. Athletes stay focused on their aspirations, as Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 9, and this is also true of us. Think what life would be like, not just for a high school athlete, but for an athlete that's trying to compete in the Olympics. And the athlete says, well, this is important to me, and I'm going to go out and compete twice a year, Christmas and Easter. What kind of athlete are we going to have? Is that man going to have any hope of winning the race? Probably not finishing the race, let alone winning the race. And yet, some people, when they think about the Christian life, a couple times a year, every once in a while, as far as our involvement with God or His Word, that's going to be enough for us. That does not fit 1 Corinthians 9, Hebrews 12, and 2 Timothy chapter 2. Athletes must sacrifice some things. If we listen to athletes, successful athletes, they'll talk about how part of their body has been damaged. Maybe it was that running in the younger years that has left them with leg damage. Maybe it is the athlete that took a pounding because of boxing. And he says, my mental faculties are not as good as they once were before I became involved with this kind of competition. If we are a Christian, we're also going to suffer some things. We're going to suffer some pain. We're going to lose out on some things in life. We have that ongoing spiritual struggle to be in a right relationship with God. But it's worth it. As we live the Christian life, we need to realize, looking at the life from an athletic standpoint, that we are in a training camp. Our entire life is a training camp that is designed to bring us closer and closer to God, to improve our spiritual life. So at the end of time, God will say, come ye blessed of my Father. Why? Because we went through the training process. Because we were that athlete that decided to go ahead and run the race. Hebrews 12, verse 1, we ran with patience. And God says, here's the victory. I'm ready to give you the crown of life. Come in and enjoy the things prepared for you from the foundation of the world. The image of athletics is a great symbol for the Christian life. But it is by no means the only symbol. In addition to symbolizing Christianity with athletes, Jesus once symbolized Christianity with the imagery in John 15. You may remember the lengthy discussion there. He talks about himself being the vine, and he said his people are the branches. That's the information specifically from verse 5. In Israel, grapes were a very popular crop. I believe that they still are today. So when Jesus gives this illustration in John 15, it would have made a great deal of sense to those in the first century. Grapes are an interesting symbol for the Christian life. For many reasons. For instance, grapes, if you've had them, if you've grown them, they're a nice thing to have, but you know, they can also be a pain in the neck. Grapes are a little bit of a pain. It would be nice to be able to plant grapes and they produce that first year. But that's not the way that they work. Grapes have to grow for 2, probably 3, 4, maybe even 5 years before they produce something. And it's kind of a pain having to go out there and deal with the bugs and prune them and do all the various things that need to be done. As I think about the Christian life, is this not also the case for God's people? Christians can be a little bit of a pain at times for God. Now, we might not think that that's God's attitude, but when we go back and we look at the nation of Israel, God was frustrated with his people when they didn't do what was right. We would expect then under the New Testament era that there are still times where God is frustrated. When we think about grapes, we find that it takes a while before they begin to produce fruit. Such is also typically true for Christians. When a person has been baptized, they're on the road to being a child of God, to being an effective fruit producer for God's people. But oftentimes, several months go by, maybe several years go by, before that Christian is actually producing a lot of fruit in the spiritual life. But just as a person is patient with that grape crop, he doesn't say, well, you didn't produce any grapes this year, I'm going to chop you down. No, he's patient. Such is also true with God. He waits, he's patient, as his people need learn how to produce fruit. When we think about grapes, they need to be pruned. They need, about this time of year, to go have someone go out and chop off the old stuff. And sometimes God needs to do some pruning with his people. Hebrews 12 talks about the need sometimes for chastisement. So it's a symbol that makes a great deal of sense. As we think about this particular imagery, we find something else that's true about it. We find that based on the grape illustration, that grapes, they have, as we look at their branches, an interesting and unusual combination. There is strength as well as weakness. Those branches of grapes, they're sturdy enough, they're strong enough to actually hold the grapes. But if you were to go out there and start twisting it this way and that way, you would find that those branches, which are strong enough to hold the grapes, they're not strong enough to resist that twisting and the turning. In other words, there's also a sense in which they're very fragile. As we think about this part of a branch on a grapevine, we also find application to the Christian realm. We should be strong enough, like that grapevine is, to hold grapes. We should be strong enough to be able to endure. That brings us back to the image of athletics. God says you need to run the race. You need to have the endurance. You need to have the perseverance so that you can get to the final spot you need to be. You need to be faithful all the way. But at that same time, as we're running the athletic race of the Christian life, when we begin to think about the perspective in John chapter 15, that the Lord says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. We're also people that can be broken. Broken sometimes very easily. And not only can we be broken, but other people, depending on how we deal with them, can be broken. So the Christian life, in addition to being like an athlete, the image of a branch tells us that we need to be very careful. Because the strength that we have, there's also some weakness there. So we need to be wary of being a branch breaker. And sometimes that happens with people. They turn out to be branch breakers. When we think about grapes, there is that trunk that is connected to the branches. And if we want to be a branch that has life in ourselves, we've got to be connected to the trunk. That trunk, of course, is Christ. That's why the Bible says, as we looked at this morning, he's the head of the church. And we have, we maintain, we keep that connection with Christ. If a grapevine never produced fruit, we had the vine after 5 years, no fruit. 6 years, 10 years, 15 years. Most people would say, well, you've been there long enough. And we're not going to keep any longer. We're going to get a vine that produces. Such is also true for Jesus. In John 15, he said, if people are not producing fruit, and he recognizes the need for people to develop and mature, but he makes it clear in John 15, he said, if you are not finally producing fruit, you're going to be cut off. Once again, a great symbol for the Christian life. Our third symbol. After thinking about athletics and after thinking about a vine that is attached to the trunk of a grape, in Romans 7, verse 4, or 7, 1 through 4, Paul talks about the image of marriage. And when we think about Christianity, it is symbolized also by things like marriage and a bride. In Romans 7, verses 1 through 4, Paul said if a woman gets married, she is not entitled, as she's in that relationship, to a second man. Paul said a woman can only have, in God's eyes, with God's approval, one guy at a time. But if a woman's husband dies, then Paul says that relationship has been dissolved in the eyes of God, and she is then potentially able to be joined or married to another. Paul used that illustration to say people were once joined to the Old Testament, but that Old Testament has now been taken out of the way, and now people are joined to another. Just as a woman would be joined possibly to another spouse, so Christians have been joined to another, that is, the New Testament, the New Covenant. The image of marriage is used here, as well as elsewhere in the New Testament, to describe God's people. And sometimes this image of marriage is presented in terms of a bride. You may remember in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, Paul used this same symbol to describe God's people. He said to the church there, I want to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. Ephesians 5, 22 to 32, once again, the image of a bride. Consider some of the things that are associated with a bride. A bride might be used to symbolize commitment. As a woman stands there before the preacher, the justice of the peace, she promises things like, I'm going to love you. I'm going to honor you. I'm going to cherish you for life. A woman also, as she stands there and makes a commitment to a man, she typically surrenders part of her name. That woman will give up her last name and take on the name of her husband. I'm amazed at the number of people who claim to be a follower of Christ, but they will not take on the Lord's name. Imagine worshiping at a place which identifies itself as the Church of Barnabas. Now, to me, that is unthinkable. Who would want to identify with a man named Barnabas rather than Christ, who bought the church, who built the church, and who is the head of the church? Barnabas did not die for the church. The symbol of a bride is suggestive of the fact that we need to wear the name of the groom. That groom, of course, would be Jesus. A bride, as noted a few moments ago, promises to forsake all others for the man that she loves. I'm giving up everybody else. I'm not going to date anyone else because I love you. Is this not also true for the Christian? Does not the image of a bride symbolize that we are becoming the exclusive property of Christ? We don't want another religious leader. We love Christ so much that we're willing to forsake everyone else. That was Jesus' point in Matthew 10, verse 37. He said, if you want to be my follower, you need to be willing to give up mom and dad. At least they need to be second or third in life. I have to be number one. Your friends have to be subservient. They have to be below Christ. A bride, as we think about her, she says, I'm yours till death. Sickness, sorrow, whatever it is, I am yours until there's no longer life in my body. Is this not also true when we think about Christianity? Revelation 2:10, be thou faithful how long? Even to the point of death. Brides are known for making their wedding day a very special event. In fact, many of us, I think, have seen a woman, and maybe a man, who was so focused on the wedding that they didn't give much attention to the marriage. They get the wedding out of the way, and then, oh, hey, we're married, what do we do now? But sometimes it happens. Those who become Christians also have a special day. That day, of course, is the day of the baptism, the day that they are joined to Christ. Some time ago, a man wrote a book with an interesting title. I've not read it yet. I've been tempted. But the title of the book is Baptism, the Believer's Wedding Ceremony. And that is exactly right. The day that we become part of Christ's bride, it should be the most important day in our life. As we think about brides, and most of us have seen one come down the aisle, we find that these ladies are typically dressed in the most attractive way possible. I'm pretty sure that none of us have ever seen a bride come down the aisle dressed in sweatpants and with her hair all messed up. That probably would make the local newspaper. Brides want to maximize their physical beauty. They want to be seen as someone that is attractive, especially on that day. Well, as we think about the church, God's people being symbolized by a bride, is there not a lesson there? As we go through the Christian life, if we are the bride of Christ, how does God want us to appear? Does he want us to appear like that bride on her wedding day where she is stunning? That's the implied message. Now, we know that the appearance is not the outward man. Sometimes people are outwardly beautiful, outwardly attractive, and that's hypocrisy. But when we think about a bride, it's the kind of life that Peter described in 1 Peter 3:4. He talked about a woman with a beautiful heart. He refers there to the hidden man of the heart. It is that loveliness that needs to symbolize God's people because we are the bride of Christ. If God could take our life, our spiritual life, and he could somehow fashion that into a woman who's a bride on a wedding day, what would that woman look like? Would that woman, as she comes down the aisle, people would just look and say, wow, look at her. Or if our Christian life were taken and fashioned into a bride, would people think, boy, she just escaped from a tornado. Look at her. Look at how awful she looks. It's a thoughtful question. As we're running the race and as we seek to be a branch that is so attractive, it's like a stunning bride. We think about our minds turn to another symbol. And this symbol is found in another of the books that Paul authored. It's found in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 9. It may be a symbol that we don't always associate with Christianity, at least immediately. But Paul said, for we are God's fellow workers. Ye are God's husbandry. And then at the end of the verse, he gives us a symbol. You are God's building. Now, this is a fascinating symbol because buildings come in all kinds of varieties. We might stand outside a large building. And as we look at that building, because of the enormity of the structure, we think, wow, look at that. We're impressed by the size. But were we to go into that warehouse or large building, we might think, well, there's nothing in here but empty space. We find sometimes other buildings, they seem so small from the outside. But as we go inside and we see that, yes, it is a smaller area, but every inch of space has been used. There are some buildings that are plain but very important. When we think about God symbolizing his church or his people as a building, this is a point that could be developed in a lot of different ways. We could look at it individually, or we could think about it congregationally. Individually, God has not obligated us to be the biggest and prettiest building. That's, I think, a helpful point as we consider the Christian life. What is required of us, though, is to be a building or like a building that has a solid structure. We, as we think about buildings, if we're going to buy one, if we're going to use one, we want a building that has a solid structure. We don't want to have any problems with structure. Well, that's akin to the Christian life in that when we think about our foundation, our spiritual foundation, it needs to be a good foundation. That good foundation is going to be the Word of God. It needs to be solid in every respect so it can withstand the assaults of the devil. A building also suggests some things from a congregational perspective. Imagine, of a lot of RV companies in this area, and imagine that there was an RV company where in the office area, they've got initially one office area. There are 12 people in the office, and the 12 office workers do not get along. I mean, there's just constant bickering, constant fussing. So one day, the manager of the office says, well, let's get a solution. We can't get along here in the building, so let's just build 6 additional buildings. And we'll take 6 of our employees that can't get along, and we'll put 1 in each of the 6 additional buildings, and that'll solve the issue. Well, people would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. You're going to have to work that out. We're not going to build 6 different buildings just because people can't get along. In the secular realm, people would say that this kind of idea is crazy. But in the spiritual realm, oftentimes this is precisely how many people reason. Well, if we can't get along, we're just going to go somewhere else and we're going to worship in another place or we're going to start another group. When the image of a building is used to symbolize the Christian life, the image there is one of unity, among other things. If we have created the right foundation, if we're doing the right things to keep that building going in the way that it should go, it's going to be a unified group of people. Unity is also seen in the other symbols that we've set forward tonight. When we think about branches on a vine, don't they all stay together? It has to work that way. When we think about a bride, she's a person who learns how or needs to learn how to be united to her husband. When we think about athletes, they need to be united. They need to be united with their coach. They need to be united with their teammates. There has to be a harmonious relationship if they want to succeed. Other symbols of the Christian life. We think about, for example, the book of Revelation. Chapter 1. The book of Revelation has all kinds of symbols. In Revelation 1, verse 20, John uses the symbol of a candlestick or a lampstand. We live in a time where nighttime can almost be as bright as day. It's possible sometimes to go into a person's backyard, and when they turn on the floodlights that are attached to the back of their house, we can play volleyball and do all kinds of other things that 100 years ago people would not have been able to do. But there are still times where we find in our lives we have a use for a candle. Maybe the power goes out and that's what we happen to use, or maybe we depend on something like a lantern. I'm glad. I'm really glad that in Revelation 1 verse 20, John compared the Christian life. He symbolized the Christian life as something like a candlestick. I'll tell you why. As an individual Christian, as a preacher, I cannot change the whole world by myself. It's impossible. If I work 24/7, if I work for 1,000 years, there'd still be a lot of darkness in the world. My little candlestick is not enough to vanquish all the darkness in the world. Such was also true for Paul. It was true for Peter, for Matthew. Even if you got all the apostles together, they individually and collectively still could not vanquish all the darkness in the world. This congregation, if we were twice the size or 3 times the size or 10 times the size that we are, we still could not vanquish all the darkness in our county. But by using that symbol of a candlestick, God tells us something about darkness. We do not have to individually or even congregationally get rid of all the darkness. The candlestick symbolizes the fact that we simply need to shine and shine consistently to the best of our ability. Maybe as we shine, nobody's going to see that light. Maybe the people who see it will not be that influenced by it. Maybe several will be influenced by it. But, you know, as I think about the symbol there in Revelation 1, verse 20, it reminds me a little bit about the Motel 6 commercial. We'll leave the light on for you. You may not choose to stay with us. You may not like our motel. You may choose another place that's a lot fancier. But here at Motel 6, the light is going to be left on for you. And that needs to be our motto in the Christian life. We're going to be that athlete that's running the race. We're going to be that branch that's attached to the vine. Oh, it may not be a big branch. It may not be the most productive branch. We're going to use all the symbols. We're going to be the best bride that we can be. And we're going to make sure that our light is shining in our world. As we think about the symbols that are used to describe Christians, these symbols tell us who we are. They tell us what we are. They tell us what we are to do. And they also tell us that God loves us. Oftentimes, we're like that branch that's a pain. And sometimes we need to be pruned. But God says, I love you. You're like a beautiful bride. And I want you to produce fruit. I want you to do the best that you can. I want you to run that race. And as we run that race, we know from athletics that they sometimes stumble. Sometimes they come in huffing and puffing. Sometimes there's a perspiration there. But there's someone there to help. And that's also true for God. He's given us so many symbols to communicate his love for us, to communicate the fact that we need to continue to press on in the Christian life. And tonight, we hope that these are the choices that you've made, that you've entered the race. You become a Christian by faith, repentance, confession, baptism. And when you fall and when you stumble, you know that God is still looking on, and you're committed to running the race with patience. You get bruised up, banged up, and some problems from time to time. But you're going to let your Christian light shine. Tonight, if you've not made that decision, we'd like to encourage you to become a Christian. If you have made that decision and for some reason you've allowed yourself to become like a sullied bride, God says there's hope. You can come back. Symbolize his love for us in so many ways. If we can help you become a Christian, help restore you as a Christian, strengthen you as a Christian, or something else, will you let us know how we can aid you as we stand and sing the selected song?